You can't go through something traumatic without it changing who you are, but you can choose how you want to see that. You know, I think one of the greatest freedoms in life is the freedom of choice. You can choose your perspective. You can always choose your own perspective.
It's easy to talk about the successes, but what doesn't get talked about enough is the struggle. My name is Eric Weinmayer. I've gotten the chance to ascend Mount Everest, to climb the tallest mountain in every continent, to kayak the Grand Canyon, and I happen to be blind. It's been a struggle to live what I call a no barriers life, to define it, to push the parameters of what it means. And part of the equation is diving into the learning process and trying to illuminate the universal elements that exist along the way. In that unexplored terrain, between those dark places we find ourselves in and the summit, exists a map. That map, that way forward, is what we call no barriers.
Today, we'll meet Sean Sorner, the first cancer survivor to stand on top of Mount Everest. Diagnosed with two deadly, different, and unrelated forms of cancer, once at age 13, and again at age 16, Sean astounded the medical community when he survived both. He realized that after defeating cancer twice, no challenge would ever be too great, no peak too high. He has since topped the seven summits and skied both the South and North Poles. He continues to test his own endurance and inspire and motivate people around the world with his message of hope. He founded the nonprofit organization, the Cancer Climber Association, and is now an author, speaker, and most recently, the feature of the documentary, True North.
Welcome everybody to the No Barriers Podcast. We are happy to be back here again with you today with another amazing guest to join us today. We are still just kind of coming off of the Thanksgiving break, and really in Colorado, we're full bore winter right now. Contrary to the past few years that we've had.
And 2 feet of pow.
I mean, it's been big. I was just backcountry skiing. It's literally, I can count on one hand the number of seasons in 30 years I've lived in Colorado that I've skied five times before December 1st, and just went out yesterday and was charging hard. But Eric.
Yeah, and wait, because our last guest before the interview said, hey, what sports do you do, Jeff? And you said, I do it all.
Well, I don't want to get pigeonholed like you, because I'm asking you beforehand, like, bro, are you like, you ready to go skiing? You're like, I'm not really into skiing.
It's still late November. I'm just not into ski mode yet.
Yeah, but okay. So let's,
yeah.
There's still some sunny days out there to be enjoyed. Yeah, we got to diversify your portfolio.
Yeah, it's true.
So, but you're not willing to give up the rock yet because it's just too hot and sunny. So where are you going?
I'm going to Wadi Rum, which is where they filmed Lawrence of Arabia. So I'm going to go work there, and then I'm going to climb for a week afterwards.
Well, where is
it? It is in Jordan, and it's in the desert, and we're going to be at a desert camp climbing every day. They're big, like 700 meter, 2,000 foot towers.
Is it sandstone?
Yeah, it's sandstone, and it's a little crumbly, but it's a lot of crack climbing and things like that. So anyway, my rock climbing season hasn't quite ended yet.
And then you'll strap the skis on.
Eventually, I'll get the mood to ski.
Yes, you will.
We sound very privileged and spoiled talking about our pursuits here.
It's called outdoor attention deficit disorder.
Yeah. I mean,
you got to change the equipment from season to season. It's okay.
Well, we got a great guest here. This is a local legend, Sean Sorner. Welcome, Sean. It's amazing. I mean, you've done so many things. It's nuts. I mean, you must be 85 years old.
Do you feel 85 years old?
You don't look it. I thank you. I'm actually 120.
You're 120. Yeah. It took you 120 years to do all the things that you've done.
But what is it, like Benjamin Button, though?
Yeah.
Aging in reverse.
He's climbed the seven summits. He's skied to the South Pole, the North Pole. He's done an Ironman, right?
Hawaii Ironman. Yeah, one's enough, I think.
One's enough, yeah, for sure. Zero are enough for me. And just a lot of amazing stuff. You speak, you have a film out, you have a book. I mean, lots of different series of books.
And pending nuptials.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Pending nuptials, yeah.
Yeah.
February 9th, we're getting married in Puerto Rico.
That's exciting.
So an amazing resume, and you've had some struggles. You're part of the No Barriers Club, I would say.
Yeah, I suppose, but it's kind of funny you were talking about you heading to Jordan. I was thinking, you know, I don't have it too rough either because I'm going to Aruba for Christmas.
Yeah.
Cashing in a bunch of frequent flyer miles on American and heading down there with some timeshare points for my fiance's family.
Pretty cool. And the hardcore side of life, what do you like about adventure? You know, the non-Aruba adventures.
Well, I don't know, man. The sun down there is pretty intense. I like pushing myself. I like finding out, you know, what makes me tick and kind of the core of seeing, I guess, my limitations, if that makes sense.
Have you found your limitations?
I have not yet, but I suppose, you know, like we said earlier, my next big adventure is marriage. So maybe that'll be more
marriage
difficult.
Marriage will teach you some limitations for sure, bro.
Give you good humility.
Yeah.
Right. That will be my limitation after that. Maybe a kid or two here or there, if I can have kids.
Yeah.
You know, because of the chemo and everything. So I've had two cancers, but.
Let's not brush right through that. So
yeah, just two cancers.
Just two cancers.
Yeah, I mean, which is the great part about life is you didn't get one cancer. You got two.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose I'm.
And you don't get to climb with, you know, two good lungs. Right. You get to climb with one lung.
Yeah, one lung up Everest is.
So we have a cancer framework for the whole thing, but prior to being diagnosed. What was your routine back then, and when was that?
Well, let's I guess if somebody's quick in math, I was 13 in 1988, so you can figure out how old I am. But I was just a normal kid in Willard, Ohio, you know, just a normal Midwest guy where my backyard was, a bean field or a corn field, depending on the season. And I would knock over the corn stalks to build a fort. You know, I was just a typical corn-fed Midwestern boy. You know, I loved life, and I swam at an early age, and pushed myself even when I was young.
Were you into traditional sports?
I was mainly into swimming. That was the biggest one. But then I also ran track, cross country. I tried football for a little bit. I even pole vaulted and soccer. So yeah, I'd say I tried a lot of different things.
A lot of lung intensive sports, actually.
Yeah, a lot of aerobic stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of aerobic stuff. A lot of climbers are ex swimmers, it seems like.
Yeah, it does seem like that. You know, so maybe, you know, but I also, you know, kind of totally off the subject, I have a genetic defect in my heart where I have two superior vena cavas, which are the veins that pump oxygenless blood back to your lungs to get your body rejuvenated again with oxygen. So it's almost like, you know, somebody upstairs knew I was going to lose a lung.
Interesting. So, but you didn't know this at the time.
No clue.
So, all right. Was it a lightning bolt sort of moment that you and your family realized this as a young kid that you had this diagnosis?
You know, it wasn't just a lightning bolt type thing. It was a knee injury, you know, and then that knee injury, looking back at it, because the kind of starting from the back end, I was diagnosed at 13 with Hodgkin's lymphoma. And because of the lymph system and how it works, when I had that knee injury, that triggered every other joint to go so haywire that I swelled up and looked like the Pillsbury Doughboy. So
you just swelled up one day?
Swelled up one day because of the knee injury.
Right.
And then my lungs started gurgling and everything else. And the doctor initially stuck me in the local hospital. Like I said, Willard, Ohio, population 5,000. And they started treating me for pneumonia. And you can't exactly cure pneumonia, you can't exactly cure cancer by sucking on a nebulizer. So I wasn't getting any better. Then they stuck me to Columbus, Ohio, and after doing a number of tests, I can't tell you how many vials of blood they took. I was treated as an adult, so even when I did when I had the bone marrow test, which is when they go in the back of your back down here, right above your butt cheeks, with this basically this surgical drill, and they try to aspirate some of your marrow. Mm-hmm. They went in and the first time aspirated a piece of bone, they had to do it two more times. So that was probably the most painful thing I ever had. Happened to me. But then they finally diagnosed me with advanced stage 4 Hodgkin's lymphoma. And they told my parents, hey, your firstborn son has 3 months to live.
All right. Well, you know, obviously, Mom, I can't imagine being a parent, you know, what that would be like.
Yeah. What was it like for your parents?
For your parents specifically.
You know, looking back at it, being 44 now and thinking about having children, and I have a nephew, actually two nephews. Looking back at it, in me being 13 at the time, then 16 the second time with a different cancer, which I'm sure we'll get into, I didn't really understand fully what I was going through because I was 13. I was young. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know what death meant. You know, hey, you're going to be dead in 3 months. I had no concept of what that even meant. But looking at it from my parents' side, I bet you it was more difficult on them.
Absolutely.
Because you can't take that illness away from your child. You can't go in there and say, "Hey, cancer, be gone." And there's nothing they can do except for be there.
Yeah, being a powerless parent is the worst feeling in the world, right? Did you have brothers? Do you have brothers and sisters?
One brother.
Uh huh.
Yep, younger but taller. He's 6'7".
So he was part of the fabric, just going through that struggle with you as well, right?
He was passed off to friends and family, you know, and every once in a while we'll get together now, you know, years, 25, 26 years later, and have a couple of drinks, and we'll be, you know, arm in arm, and I'll be like, "I'm sorry, man, I'm sorry for what I put you through." And he's like, it's okay. But at the time, yeah, he just got passed off to family members and friends because, you know, I would go down to the hospital, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, dad would come down Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And I was just, our entire lives as a family was on hold.
Yeah. Because you all go into survival mode, right?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, because I remember there was one time I woke up in the morning getting ready for school. This was probably partway into the treatment. You know, so at this point, I'm about 60 pounds overweight, and it was horrible on me because I'd always been an athlete. Now I was just bloated, 60 pounds overweight.
Is that from like chemo or?
The prednisone.
Prednisone, the
steroid, yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting on the side of the bed and off to my left side, I remember seeing just a ton of hair on my pillow, you know, and that was the moment that my hair started falling out because of the chemo. And I remember running into the bathroom and staring myself in the mirror, almost in tears. You know, and just kind of figuring out where the hair was coming out. But eventually I went back into the shower. I turned the shower on. And while I was in the shower, all of my hair fell out. So I was thinking, you know, first of all, I collapsed to the floor. I literally just sat there on the floor until the water ended up running cold. And I had just clumps of hair in my hands, you know, tears running down my face. I was pulling chunks of hair out of the drain. And I was thinking about what my friends were doing that morning. You know, they were out worried about the coolest hairstyles. They were worried about the coolest shoes, the nicest clothes, being in the popular cliques, whatever it might be. You know, here I am. And that was the moment I decided that I had two choices. I could either fight for my life or give up and die.
But isn't that so, I mean, like, that's such a powerful story because it's like the cancer, you're diagnosed with advanced stage 4 cancer. That's not the moment. It's that tangible moment of feeling your hair coming out of your head. It seems like that's the moment of where it's real.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think it's moments like that where something happens to you personally. It's not when you are told something's happening to you. It's in the moment where you're almost, for me, you know, when I was by myself and it's kind of smacked me in the face. I was like, holy shit, you know, I'm diagnosed with cancer. Like I said, those were my two options. I could either fight or die.
Well, because you're in the corner of the ring at that point, right?
Exactly.
Right.
You know, it's kind of like putting a rat in the corner. You know, he's going to fight and tear and claw. And I think that's what came out in me. And I think I learned that from my parents because a long time ago when I was a swimmer, they always told me that I didn't have to be the best. I just had to be my best and constantly improve myself one day at a time. You know, maybe I swam the 50 breaststroke and I went a 30. You know, next time I should go like a 29.8, just constantly improve myself a little bit. And I did that through the cancers as well.
But at the age of 13, my son's 13, and I know how limited the scope of a 13-year-old mind is very, very well. I can't imagine at 13 you understood the profound nature of where you were, and perhaps, you know, was seeing your parents emotionally affected by what you were going through? Did that impact you, you know, as a son? Or were you so, like, sort of just smacked across the face? And it was hard for you to process? I'm trying to...
You know, I think looking back at it and comparing, well, not comparing, but just looking at different perspectives, like your son and what I went through, you know, those are two completely different perspectives on the world. You know, in my reality, my world was the hospital system. You know, it quickly became the hospital system and my family became the nurses, the doctors. You know, the Dr. Davis came in and he would always say, "Hello, friend," before he picked out my chart my medical chart at the bottom of the hospital bed. He'd always come in, grab my feet, "Hello, friend." You know, so we became a close-knit family group. And your son, I'm hoping, has never experienced that. You know, so I think I was forced to take a different perspective on life than most 13-year-olds. I think I was 13 going on 40, understanding the differences in the fragility of life.
So then do you kind of, you know, you go through treatment, right? And you miraculously start improving, right? And then number two?
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to believe that this story, you know what I mean, is not like a fictional book or something.
Oh yeah. No kidding. And I'll be honest with you. I sometimes have survivor's guilt.
Yeah.
You know, because the second time around I was diagnosed with a type of cancer that affects 3 out of 1 million people with a prognosis of 6%.
What was the time span?
So the first cancer, Hodgkin's lymphoma, advanced stage 4, I went through chemo treatments for about a year. I was in remission for a year.
When you were in 13, 14,
yeah. Yep. And then 15, I was in remission for a year, and I was going in for a regular checkup for the first cancer when they found a second cancer, which was another primary tumor, another primary cancer, completely unrelated to the first
one. So they're not related. That's even more unrelated. That's just more insanity.
Yeah. And you know, a lot of doctors would say, you know, maybe it's a secondary cancer from the treatments. But the thing is, they're completely unrelated, and I'm the only person who's ever been diagnosed with both of those cancers.
In the world.
In the world.
You're getting the Guinness Book of World Records then.
Yeah, right.
for more than just climbing.
Yeah, right. But it's crazy because I've done the math on this, and the prognosis for the second cancer is 6%. And if you add in both of those cancers, the chances of me surviving both of those cancers is equivalent to winning the lottery 4 times in a row with the same numbers. So I mean, it's impossible.
Yeah. Are you just like, how do you react to that? So overwhelming. You just must be in disbelief, right? Like you're stunned?
Oftentimes I am. You know, oftentimes, you know, I'll lay in bed and wake up in the morning and just think to myself, A, how lucky I am, and then B, you know, how different things could have been.
We've never really gone here on this podcast before, but where does your faith come into play with any sort of faith-based commitment that you have,
or nothing at all,
or not? But was that something where you brought up in a like a secular home, and then did that play into your parents' maneuvering or yours?
I think it was both. My mom was raised Catholic. My dad was raised Protestant. I was raised Methodist, so kind of in the middle. And I definitely think my faith has had something to do with me being alive. But I also don't want to say it's a silver bullet. You know, prayer didn't get me through. Faith didn't get me through. Mm-hmm. I think it was a combination of pretty much everything. It was kind of like the Perfect Storm, the movie The Perfect Storm, but in a good way. So I think it was modern medicine, family support, prayer, and just an inner will to not give up. You know, just an inner will to keep moving forward and, again, go one day at a time to make those days become a habit as opposed to, you know, focusing on the negatives. And here's actually, this just hit me too. I think what happened was the second time around, I wasn't focused on not dying. I was focused on living.
Because you had this prior experience?
Exactly.
Yeah.
What does that mean? Like you wanted to do things, right? Living.
Exactly. Yeah. I wasn't focused on not dying. I was focused on living. So I wanted to put my energy and my focus on what I wanted, not the avoidance of something that I didn't want.
And at that time, it was like maybe getting your license and going out on dates and
be normal,
right?
Yeah.
Be a kid.
Exactly.
And were you diagnosed or they gave you 14 days?
They gave me 2 weeks to live. 14 days to live a second time.
And then what's a medically induced coma? They put you into a medically induced coma?
So the second time around, because no one's ever had those two cancers before, the doctors didn't know what was going to happen. They were like, all right, well, here's, you know, a chemical cocktail. Let's just give them everything we have. But if there was anything good about having the second cancer, it was that a couple of the chemotherapy treatments I was receiving were also good for Hodgkin's lymphoma. So if there was any residual left of the Hodgkin's, it was being killed by the second cancer.
They were just napalming your ass, right?
I know. I mean, you turn off the lights, I actually glow still.
Dropping the napalm on you. Well, so I mean, and the reason I asked that earlier is because at some point in your mind, as you've grown, and anyone who's in your orbit has to say, like, the universe is a really interesting energy vortex, and to throw you this twice, come on, you know, like. That falls out of the realm. You mentioned the math, but that falls out of the realm of possibilities,
right?
Really, it does. So you got to this numeric anomaly, really, right?
Right.
I mean, like, this is what happens. You survive, you beat the 14 days. Everybody's like, holy shit, he's still alive. And then do you regain your normalcy at some point? And then when does the, I'm going to basically stand up even stronger and more of a badass than I ever could have imagined?
And what hit me was, did you go back to normal? I think I went back to finding a new normal. You know, I don't think I could have gone back to who I was, knowing what I had seen going through those two cancers. You know, because you learn a lot about yourself. Obviously, when you're climbing, you know, you learn a lot about yourself because you spend a lot of time alone. But when you're going through cancers and you're faced with, you're literally looking in the mirror and you're walking hand in hand with the Grim Reaper, and you learn a lot about yourself because you have to go inside and see what you want to fight for.
What about the loss side? Like when I went blind, I remember afterwards always like fearing, there was some fear like, what if I lose my hearing now? What if I lose more? Like, is life just a succession of losing things? And that would be like almost like a trauma in my brain. Is that, did you feel anything like that? Like, is this going to happen again and again and again?
You know, it still comes up. I get going for a checkup once a year. And when I was put in remission, I went in once a month for a checkup, you know, do blood work, CAT scan, whatever. And then it was every 3 months, then every 6 months, and then once a year. And because no one's ever had these cancers, I still go in once a year. And I tell my friends, I'm like, look, hey, I'm going to be a little different until I get the results back. Because, you know, right. Everybody sits there and worries about it. Like you said, my family, you know, my friends, everyone. But again, what good does it serve me to sit there and worry about it? You know, I could hop in my car and drive home and potentially get into a, knock on wood, you know, get into a car accident and life's over. So why would I want to worry about that stuff? Yes, it does happen, but I just want to constantly focus on the positives. I want to constantly focus on what I want, not what I want to avoid.
So was that you're saying that was a proactive decision at that young age?
I think so, because, you know, the second time around, I was like, all right, well, shit, I had the first cancer. I don't want to go through it again. You know, I'm going to lose my life. I'm going to lose my friends. I'm going to lose my hair. My life is going to be over until I get better again.
Did you lose your hair again?
Again, yeah.
Because you're like round two.
But Eric, you don't know this, but Sean's got a super coiffed, nice head of hair.
I need a haircut.
Yeah, I mean, but it grew in well.
It did. It did.
Yes, he's got twice as much hair as you do.
Now, I've also heard this phenomenon. I read something where it's like when you survive improbable things, you have a sense of almost like invincibility, like I can survive anything.
You know, I had that when I was in college, but I think everybody has that in college because I turned into Belushi from Animal House. I mean, I had a blast. But I, you know, getting older now, I understand the ramifications of my actions, and I'm starting to think, oh, you know, I'm 44 years old now, and I'm getting a little nervous about things, and you know, what about my savings? What about the future? Because now I'm finally starting to wrap my head around the fact that when I was younger going through the treatments, there were nights I went to bed, honestly, not knowing if I was going to wake up the next morning. So my future literally was right then and there, and potentially maybe the next day. But now I'm like, okay, I'm getting married. You know, I'm thinking about kids, if I can have kids. And I'm thinking about the future, and I'm having a hard time with that still. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll have some, not anxiety attacks or anything, but just some nervousness. And I just calm myself down and think, all right, well, just, you know, be here, because you never know what's going
to
happen.
Am I reading into it? Like, okay, to plan out a mountain, which is short term, you know, even Everest 3 months, is maybe in some ways easier than planning out long-term future with your fiance, let's say, or with things that, you know, where you're going to be around for the next 30, 40, 50 years.
I would say probably.
Yeah.
You know, well, because if you look at marriage, you know, you're worried about other people.
Yeah. You're climbing. It's you.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's you. Yep. And you're sitting at the South Col and you're freezing your nuts off. Well, yeah, that's you. But now you're thinking, well, yeah, I've got somebody else that's on the rope with me now. And there's a lot more weight with that.
How do you get your mind in that mode that you're talking about? Like as a teenager, like how do you get back? What does life look like when you go back to the new normal or go to this new normal?
I guess the new normal would be at that moment, whatever I wanted it to be. You know, every morning I wake up, I tell myself, literally the past is gone. There's nothing I can do about it. The future for me may never come. Tomorrow may never get here. So no matter what happens today, today's the best day ever. So every morning I wake up, I have some affirmations. I tell myself today's the best day ever. And regardless of what happens, I'm still alive and I'm still looking at the flowers from, you know, the top as opposed to the roots. So no matter what happens today, it's the best day I'm ever going to have.
All right. So where did the climbing and adventuring come
in? Yeah, how do you go from Ohio to the South Pole?
From your deathbed in Ohio.
Yeah.
And then you went to college, right?
Right.
And then you were just like engorging, basically, right? Just taking it all in. Like, I'm alive and I'm just going to eat life up. But then the climbing had to come in there. Who planted that seed and where did it come from?
Well, I started off molecular bio in college. I thought I was going to, you know, splice genes and cure cancer by playing God and fixing everything and everyone in the world. I took immunology and organic chemistry, and it's very difficult to pass those courses when you're partying too much and not opening a book and not studying.
Or sober.
Or exactly. Yeah.
I know that.
So I took the GRE, went to the grad school, wanted to be a psychologist for cancer patients. And there was a moment in my life when I was working down there, I was working three jobs, working through grad school, when I decided, okay, well, this isn't who I want to be. I want to be someone else. And I wanted to look back at my life. And I realized that I had so many issues from my cancer, because you can't go through something traumatic without it changing who you are. But the greatest thing about life is that you can choose how you want to see that. You know, I think one of the greatest freedoms in life is the freedom of choice. You can choose your perspective. You can always choose your own perspective. So when I was working for my master's and my doctorate, I was going to be a psychologist for cancer patients. When I also realized, oh, hey, I have my own issues. You know, like the old analogy, when you're taking off on a plane, if oxygen masks deploy, help yourself first before you help somebody else, because otherwise you pass out and die. So I decided I had to help myself, focused on what I was doing, everything that I went through with the cancers. And then I realized that I wanted to help people touched by cancer and give them something I never had, which is hope.
You know, in a more direct way than doing research.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I thought, you know, if I worked in a hospital system, I would only be able to help the people in the hospital system. But after doing research, I found no cancer survivor had climbed Everest. And I thought, okay, well, I could use that as a 29,000 foot platform for hope. And that's not just working in a hospital system. That would give me a platform to scream around the world, hey, if some schmuck with one lung's climbing Everest and after surviving two terminal cancers, you can do anything you want to.
But this is not quote unquote normal behavior. A person with one lung saying, I'm going to go climb Everest.
I mean, did you read into thin air, or what was it that like got you? what happened? I mean, where did you all of a sudden just be like, I'm going to go climb Everest?
It's a good thing I didn't read Moby Dick, right? Hunting whales. I did read, I actually have a friend. He let me read Into Thin Air. I started reading a bunch of stuff on Everest. And initially I thought maybe I could run across the country and visit local hospitals and share my survivorship story with the patients, which I still want to do within the next 5 years, run from like LA to New York or something and just visit hospitals and talk to patients.
Cool.
But I wanted something bigger and something that no one had ever done before. And that's why after doing a bunch of research, I just came up with Everest. And I was like, all right, let's start with the top. Like, you're going to go big, right?
You got to start training, obviously, and learning about how to do it safely, right?
Exactly. And I was living in Florida at the time, going to University of North Florida in Jacksonville.
Dude, what is up? You were living in Florida with one lung, and you're like, I just want to go climb Everest. Did you go to Alaska? Did you do any other climbs before you went to Nepal?
The highest mountain I climbed before I went over to Nepal was Elbert.
Elbert in Colorado, tallest peak in Colorado.
Wow.
14,500.
Holy cow. Okay. Way to shoot for the stars, bro. Yeah.
Okay. But you obviously trained.
But everybody told me I was nuts.
Let's get into that. So did doctors say this is not a wise decision?
My oncologist told me to go for it. I had a couple specialists tell me to don't even think about it. I had pretty much the entire climbing industry tell me I was crazy. We actually have a quote from somebody who said, because I lived in Estes Park, he said, 8 months in Estes Park does not a Himalayan climber make. So when I got to base camp, that was my personal record. So every step past base camp was my PR.
Yeah.
How'd you feel at base camp? How were you feeling?
I felt awesome. You know, I felt fantastic, except getting up to base camp, you know, you're not acclimatized. I think there was like a 90-year-old lady who just zipped right by me. I was like, oh God, I'm never going to make it. Uh-huh.
So every day after that, you're setting personal records going higher and higher.
So every day was the best day I've ever had, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then were there times, you know, we've been on Everest, and I know that even with both my lungs, there was times when you'd try to listen to your body and think, my body's conspiring against me right now.
I remember laying flat on my back and my heart is pounding against
my
ribs,
ears.
Like pounding so hard. I remember thinking, this could not be good.
You're sitting still.
Yeah. Right? Oh yeah. I'm lying on my back.
I could hear your back. I could hear your heart beating. Yeah. No, but I mean, so my question to you, Sean, is, you know, so you're at 26,000 feet and nothing's working right for a person with
anybody,
two lungs.
Right.
Yeah. Everybody's, you know, crapping the bed. Were there moments then where you were thinking to yourself that there is potentially a very good likelihood that my one functioning lung is going to quit and that I'm going to, you know, be a permanent fixture up here?
I was actually at Camp 3 on the way up, so the Lhotse Ice Face. And still to this day, I think it was partially cerebral edema. I came down with cerebral edema. I couldn't move the next day. You know, I had dinner the night before. I vomited dinner up, and I could still see the orange cubes of the carrots, the green peas, the spiral noodles, the beef chunks. I mean, nothing was digested. So I could see all that, and I slept
so
on
oxygen. So can we now, though. Thanks.
What's that?
Yeah. So we can see it now, too.
Yeah, I can envision it in my head.
That was awful. Yeah. With a little bile mixed in there, you know? Sweet. But it turned out to be a blessing in disguise because I stayed at Camp 3 on oxygen for that entire day and the next night and then went up to Camp 4 the day after that, and I felt completely fine. Everybody else who was on the same expedition schedule as us went from Camp 3 to Camp 4 when I couldn't leave Camp 3. They went up from Camp 4. The weather turned bad. They came back down. So they lost their window, you know, but no one summited on the 15th. I went up on the 16th, and the weather was perfectly fine.
Another little sort of galactic touch.
Exactly.
For you, dude.
I think, you know,
should be a minister.
Right?
Yeah.
I think kind of tongue-in-cheek, I have the world's worst good luck.
The world's worst good luck.
But yeah. But I also have a fleet of guardian angels working on overtime. Yeah, they're all fighting. Man. Hey, I'm done with this guy.
What was your summit day like?
It was beautiful. I mean, it was a slight wind, slight breeze, and it was just absolutely gorgeous.
But then when you got down, obviously, you know, there was this massive, like you said, a 29,000 foot platform.
Right.
And then you realized that you had the opportunity to impact a lot more people now. So was that something that you knew before you took off on this journey? Like if I do this either way, I'm going to spread my wings and really just try and touch as many lives as possible.
You know, I think the goal was to make it to the top, but the number one goal was to come home, not in a pine box, you know, and to come home alive. But it was to enjoy the journey. It was to enjoy the trip. And every step I made on the mountain, like I said, was my PR altitude record. And even just being on the mountain, you know, I trained for 8 or 9 months. That was it. You know, I did something that I do not suggest anybody doing. And looking back at it, it was crazy. It was absolutely nutty.
But a little bit fringy.
Yeah, I mean,
fringy.
You can tell me I'm an idiot. Yeah. That's fine. I've heard it many times. But I had a flag that was about this big, you know, 2 feet by 2 feet, that had names of people touched by cancer. And it was the first mountain I climbed that I wasn't doing it for myself. I was doing it for other people. And I left that flag up there, basically commemorating the struggle of cancer patients worldwide. And I wanted to, I guess, be a beacon of light for people fighting for their lives, fighting through cancer in such dark times. You know, I wanted to give them hope, and I wanted to just let them know, hey, if, like I said earlier, if some guy's out there doing these crazy things, you can survive cancer. You can go through. There is hope.
So, I mean, just biologically, though, with one less lung, you're up there in a place where you only have a third of the oxygen. I mean, do you know whether you were struggling like more than someone else, or were you just not even thinking about it, or is it just, it is what it is?
My baseline for climbing was, it started with one lung. So I don't know what it's like to climb with two lungs.
Right.
I just know that I believe in the mind-body connection. I visualized myself on top every night for 9 months when I was training. And I smelled the ozone. I heard the styrofoam crunching, the sound of the snow beneath my feet. I heard the wind blasting by my face. I felt the sun's radiation on my face. You know, so when I left Camp 4, I knew I was already on top in my mind. And I kept telling myself every step I had a mantra. I said, the higher I go, the stronger I get. The higher I go, the stronger I get. And I really think that with affirmations, you can say something over and over and over again and truly believe it. And your mind believes what you're thinking.
So let me just get you to surgically break that down real quick, because I think it's easy to say a mantra, but in order for it to really get manifested, do you have to have full buy-in? And did you really believe what you were telling yourself, or were you trying to trick yourself? Or is the answer yes? Because I find that really
interesting. All the above.
Yeah. You know what I mean?
Like, I do. And I think it starts with how people make choices every day. And, you know, if you're going through life and, like, say me going up Everest, it didn't start on Everest. It started, you know, 9, 10 months before. So I started developing a pattern, because I think human beings are products of repetition. You know, we are a representation of our repetition. So whatever we do every day kind of defines who we are, and the choices that we make define who we are. And I think that when I was on Everest, I made those choices. I kept telling myself that over and over and over again. So I don't want to say the confidence was there, but the confidence was within me to keep pushing forward. And it didn't begin on the mountain. It began, you know, months and months, maybe years ago, when I started making micro changes and making those conscious decisions to get me where I wanted to go. So I think a long time ago, I bought into it. And on the mountain, I did have those moments where I had self-doubt. And I did have those moments where I was just like, oh shit, what am I doing? You know, I could die here. You know, this could be my last day. But I was also so focused on making it to the top for those other people touched by cancer. They kept me going. They're the ones who carried me to the top. I didn't get up there by myself. And I think
that's
what I was focused
on. So you think that gives
you
a kind of strength as well when you sort of connect with that community out there?
Oh, for sure. For sure. I get my inspiration from knowing that there are people in the hospital system and at home, you know, fighting for their lives, going through cancer, knowing that they don't have the choice like we do when we're on expeditions to pick up the satellite phone and say, hey, I'm done. Get me the hell out of here. You know, and we can always go back to the mountain because as far as I know, Everest has been there for at least a few years. People fighting for their lives can't pick up their cell phone. They can't pick up the satellite phone and say, hey, you know, I'm going to take a day off. You know, I quit today, you know, because they would die. So when I think of somebody laying in the hospital bed and they're putting up with what they have to put up with, I can choose to put up and battle the element and my inner demons, I suppose, too.
So you continued to climb, though. You continued to climb the seven summits. So you continued to battle and to do an Ironman and to go to the South and the North Pole, right? So how long did that take you? What do they call that? The Grand Slam, I think.
Yeah, which people joke about it sounding like a Denny's breakfast platter.
Yeah, sounds like the Sunny Side Up.
It moves over Miami.
Yeah.
It makes no sense even where they got that from, but
it'd be cooler if it was called the Moons Over Miami.
Miami.
Yeah, but it's called the Grand Slam.
Right.
But to Eric's point, like, did you know when you did Everest that this was going to be a possibility, or did you just say, like, let's just keep this trajectory going?
I didn't even think about doing the seven summits after I got off of Everest, because when I came back, you know, I started doing some speaking. I tried to get my story into the news, the media, but it just wouldn't catch on for numerous reasons we can talk about later. But then I decided, okay, well, there are seven peaks. Someone's done the seven summits. Numerous people have done the seven summits. It's like, all right, well, let's take a flag to the highest point on every continent. So that's when I decided, all right, well, let's keep going. Let's reach around the world now and try to visit local hospitals. I visited hospitals in Russia. I visited hospitals in Argentina. I visited hospitals in Africa, you know, all over the place. And that's what keeps me going, I think.
Did you meet helping people with cancer and kids with cancer?
All over, yeah. There was one I met in Sydney at the Sydney Children's Hospital. I was in touch with him via email probably once or twice a week for a few months. And then all of a sudden, nothing. You know, and then I get an email from his mom saying that he passed away. So I can't tell you how many times that happens, and that just kills me inside. But she wrote to me saying, you know, hey, don't be sad that he's passed away, because every day he woke up, he said, look, Sean's giving me some hope. I want to be like him when I grow up. So if I can inspire one child like that, you know, to move forward, to have hope, and to enjoy the days that person has alive, then I'm doing something right.
So now that when you're finished with this great adventure, although you're still adventuring, of course, but how do you extend that mission?
Well, that's why I'm here to talk with you guys. I'll share my story, because if my story doesn't get out, then I don't think it helps anybody. You know, I think we all have two ears in one mouth for a reason, and everyone on earth has a story to tell. And if we just listen, you know, twice as much as we speak, we can literally learn something from every single person on the planet, because everyone has a different perspective.
Do you feel, though, I mean, hope seems to be the center part of your message,
huge part,
right?
Yeah.
Like, and it's that sort of purpose-driven life. And I think if I were to put myself in, you know, sort of a non-climber and pull myself away from the No Barriers universe, and I look at somebody like you, and I just say, that dude's a freak of nature. He's had these anomalies happen, and then he has experienced things that I can't even imagine experience, and then he's harnessed it in a way that I can't, you know, even imagine. But what I want to know from you is, do you feel like you've taken an abnormal life and turned it into a normal life? And is that because that's the way you're wired? Or do you feel like this sort of blessed opportunities in life that you've had have just sort of made you who you are?
I definitely think the latter. I definitely think that I'm totally blessed with my life. I also think that I would go crazy working a desk job and working in a cubicle 9 to 5 every day. I think I would go crazy. You know, I have that adventure spirit. I've always been adventurous. But the people out there who are thinking, oh, I could never do this. Again, it goes back to making a decision. When you have a choice, you make micro changes to get where you want to go. You know, so many people are fixated on what's comfortable, you know, and life begins outside your comfort zone, but fear holds them back.
Mm. What are those micro changes that you made though? Like what are those? I'm curious because those are hard to quantify sometimes.
Okay. So for example, I actually put together a program. If you want to go to thenext7days.com, the number 7, thenext7days.com. It's a program for cancer survivors, but it'll work for anybody. And it's a week-long program where you wake up on Monday and you don't turn on the news, okay, in the morning, and you don't turn on the news before you go to bed. Because what you're doing there, which is like 90% of everybody, they turn on the news when they wake up, turn on the news before they go to bed. You're bookending your day on a negative note. You know, wake up in the morning and get on your phone or your computer and Google inspirational video. Hmm. You know, start your day off with that.
So the news, you think, may be unhealthy to quote-unquote healing.
Completely. Yeah. But if you do watch it, just filter out the stuff and pay attention to how it makes you feel.
I really like that, though. So these are like very tangible things.
Very tangible. And at the end of the day, get a journal and just try it for 2 weeks. You will reprogram your brain. Write down 5 things that you're grateful for and then journal about one of them. And not what you did, but how it made you feel, because I think that helps you tap into your value system on how you, if you feel a certain way, you know, you're motivated by feelings. You know, we're human beings, not human doings. So I think if human beings can be motivated by their values, you can tap into that value system by journaling on one of those 5 things that you're super happy about, you know, how it made you feel. That way you can tap into your value system and you can motivate yourself intrinsically forever. So that way you're bookending your day on a positive note. So on Tuesday, you do something different, but you continue doing Monday into Tuesday. Tuesday, you make choices. Like say you're at work and you're going for the donut or the apple. You know, you know which one's better for you, but everybody's going to go for the fried piece of dough. I mean, it tastes great. You know, I do the same thing, but you know what? Take a bite of it, dump it in the garbage can, and then go for the apple. Because you're not going to go dumpster diving for a donut. You know, you're going to go for the apple because you're hungry. But if you start making conscious choices.
Micro changes.
Exactly. Micro changes. Start right now. People always say, oh, I'll start Monday on my diet. No, bull crap.
You know, if you're in a dark place, do you think that still applies? I mean, does it still work? Like if somebody's like, I'm not grateful for anything.
I think so. Because you will reprogram your brain and to focus on the positive aspects. Because as opposed to going to bed, turning on the news and you're thinking, man, you know, look at all this rape, look at all this murder, look at all these drugs, look at what the government's doing, the world's falling apart, you know? But if you just ignore that or get rid of it and focus on the positives, or if you do watch the news, pick out the good stuff. But if you, at the end of the day, write down things that you're grateful for, you will slowly begin to reprogram your brain. You will make different neural connections to focus on the positives. You will become a more positive person.
And I'm torn on this hope thing. I mean, obviously I'm a believer in hope, right? But hope, like you could be as hopeful as possible and you still could die, right?
True, very true.
Right? So what's your insights there? I mean, like it's not the panacea, right? But do you think it actually is a game changer? Like it actually puts the odds in your favor?
I think it does, because once you lose hope, what do you have left? You know, you can still be hopeful, but know that you're going to be dead. Well, for me, as an example, I was given 14 days to live. I had hope that I was going to live past 14. I wanted to get 15, and then 15 to 16, 16 to 17, 17 to 18. If you learn to enjoy the moments, you know, you're not going to let any fun moments pass you by. You have opportunities, and people need to realize that there are no challenges. There are no obstacles. There are only opportunities based on the perspective that you have. And if you slowly reprogram your brain based on those micro changes, you will slowly see that everything is an opportunity. Now, don't get me wrong. You know, driving here, somebody cut me off. I flipped them off. I yelled a couple things. You know, but you get it out of your system. Get it over with. But the majority of your life, if you want to, like I said, you have the choice. The majority of your life can be positive.
Are you healed? Like, do you think you're healed now? I mean, because I know that's a big part of your message too.
I go in once a year for a checkup. So I think for the rest of my life, I'm going to be in remission. I would never say I'm cancer free. I hope. Yeah.
And what about though the psyche around that though?
It does eat me up that one time a year that I get a checkup, but the other times of the years, you know, I do as much as I can and live as much as I can.
Well, that's what we all need to hear, right? Because it's easy to become complacent and just to kind of roll through things. And then to listen to you and listen to your fervor and just your general appreciation for opening your eyes in the morning. That's a reminder that everybody needs. It's easy to forget that.
Oh, for sure.
Do you feel like there's places that you could obviously still maybe even smile a little bit harder or
of course.
Yeah, or just breathe a little bit deeper in a way?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still stressed, you know, taxes, rent, mortgage, car payments, you know, whatever it might be, insurance payments.
Do you have to remind yourself like I need to drink my own Kool-Aid in a way?
Yeah, sometimes I do. This morning I woke up and I thought to myself, you know, I haven't written in my journal for a while. So I picked it up, wrote down five things I was grateful for. And I was thinking, man, you know, I give a lot of keynote talks and I'm telling people these things. I'm not doing it myself. You know, I haven't done it in a while. I was like, well, shit, I need to do it myself. Exactly. I need to drink my own Kool-Aid.
Yeah, because it's powerful.
Yeah. I just need to do it myself as well.
Yeah.
It needs to become a habit.
Well, amazing, Sean.
Yeah. And tell us about your film, True North.
Oh, yeah. It's going across the country. It was just nominated for an Emmy. It's called True North, The Sean Swarner Story. And it's the production company was The Workshop, based out of Philadelphia. And they did a phenomenal job and somehow made 80 Below look somewhat tolerable.
Where were you at 80 Below?
The North Pole.
Yeah.
That was awful. 80 Below within, I think it was 90% humidity, which is just incomprehensible. Yeah.
Oh, God.
Did they follow you around beyond just that journey? Like, if it's your story, are they seeing you in your day to day?
They did. Yeah. They actually went to a hospital when I was getting my checkup. My oncologist was there. And then we went around to different places across the country and collected names for the flag that I took to the North Pole. I mean, if you watch it, make sure you have a box of tissues.
Where do you see it?
I think it's on PBS right now, and it might be on Amazon now. I'll have to check with the production company. But if they can go to True North Doc, like documentary, truenorthdoc.com.
Cool. I can't wait to see it.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
I can't wait to hear it.
That's blind humor.
Right.
Yeah.
A little blind humor coming at you.
Sean, thanks for being with us, my man.
Yeah, thank you.
You're really, I mean, I know you hear it all the time, but you're an inspiration.
Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah, you're somebody that we can all sort of be, it's an eye-opener. Like, yes, sir, that's how you're supposed to do it. So thank you for...
That was my line. It's an eye-opener. Jeff, you stole my line.
No, but I didn't want you to have to be over the top with your blind humor. Yeah. Awesome, Sean. Thanks, buddy. Well, Eric.
That's amazing. I mean, what I like, because I like to really understand this process, and I wanted to ask him throughout the whole interview, like, what these micro changes are.
Well, you did.
And then... we really got into it. And that's really stuff that people can take away. It's very concrete stuff.
Yeah.
There's this vet that has been part of No Barriers programs, and he calls them little acts of courage. And they're just like sort of in a similar vein. You know, it's like little things that you do to begin to express the, you know, the best version of yourself. But, you know, it's just little things like turn off, you know, Fox News or CNN and focus on what you want to grow. Those are hard little steps.
Right, because it's easy to say what Sean said, but what he gave us was the opportunity to see these hard, solid, take-home maneuvers that you can take throughout your day to make these changes, because it's those little changes turn into, you know, big paradigm shifts in the end, right?
And yeah, you get like double cancer, right? And then that sort of becomes something that illuminates maybe, you know, moving in a certain direction.
You mean like radioactively?
No. But you don't have to go through that, I think. You know, for our audience, like you don't have to go through that insane trauma, right? You can make those little changes. Mm-hmm. You don't need the massive wake-up call.
Yeah. I also like how Sean talked about his new normal. And we've heard that from a few guests, but Sean really, really eloquently put it like he got to reinvent himself and decide who he was going to be. And we've heard that as a continuing theme But Sean, you know, Sean really just, you know, sort of took the script and his narrative and turned it into what he wants. Like, I think this big Mount Everest might be a good platform. So whatever, man, I'm just going to train and I'm going to take it all the way to the top. That's a reinvention right there. You know, like saying, I'm not a climber right now, but I'm going to learn to be. And why? Because I want a platform to be able to impact and touch other people. That's a reinvention. And I think anybody is capable of reinventing. And it's, and then, like you said, with these small, tangible micro changes that he referenced.
And then, yeah, you have gratitude and you see your life as a gift. Mm-hmm. Every day,
every
breath. A gift.
Yeah.
We're really lucky to have folks like Sean as part of our No Barriers community. If you want to learn more about No Barriers and be around people like this, be around this really supportive community, go to nobarriersusa.org. Come to our upcoming summit in June. It'll be in Lake Tahoe. And we'll have 1,000 people together just soaking up each other's positivity, motivation, and living this No Barriers life. So I hope you'll join us. Jeff?
Yep.
No barriers.
No barriers,
man.
See you next time. Thank you.
Thanks to all of you for listening to our podcast. We know that you have a lot of choices about how you can spend your time, and so we appreciate you spending it with us. If you enjoy this podcast, we encourage you to subscribe to it, share it, and give us a review. Show notes can be found at nobarrierspodcast.com. Special thanks to the Dan Ryan Band for our intro song, which is called Guidance. The production team behind this podcast includes producers Diedrich Jonk and Pauline Schaefer, sound design, editing, and mixing by Tyler Kottman, graphics by Sam Davis, and marketing support by Laura Baldwin and Jamie Donnelly. Thanks to all you amazing people for the great work you do.